home. We are WNST. AM 1570, Tass of Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. I'm in one of the more positive places that have come about here in Timonium. We're here at Costas Inn in Timonium in the grandstand, anticipating huge crowds this weekend as we bring the state fair back in. There'll be racing here this week. All are brought to you by friends at the Maryland Lottery. I will have crab cakes today. I'm actually having the Crab Imperial today and the Oysters Rockefeller. It's brought to you by friends at Press Your Luck and the Lucky Sevens. I'm going to have Raven scratch-offs beginning next week. I'm going to give these out at the bar. Hopefully we get some lucky winners here. There is an OTB here. There is a horse racing thing going on here. Chris Corman was here entertaining Brandon Weigel from the Baltimore Banner. My buddy Howard Scher and Bill Cole were by. So we've had a long, long, long segment about Ravens, Orioles, ownership, fans, Birdland memberships, Justin Tucker, all of that. So now I'm bringing a real journalist in. John Eisenberg's here, the author, one of my mentors, and probably working on a book and selling previous books at his football season. It's always good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Last time I had you on, I don't think the Orioles were in last place. It's been most of the summer. I've left you alone. I want to get to baseball. I definitely would do some football with you. But being in a horse racing OTB thing, the first thing you talked to Brandon Weigel about, who's a big horse racing guy, and Chris Corman, was about the dismantling of Hi-Ho Pimlico. You wrote a lot more about horse racing than I bet people know you did or had, given the book and the research you did. And whenever I've talked horse racing with you, I'm always astonished, A, how much you know about it as a journalist that you got into it, because you weren't a rail bird out there like Dale Austin or Marty McGee or guys we work with, but you took it on as a Maryland thing, being a Texas guy who went to school in Philly, to come here and really get into the pageantry of the great sport of horse racing.
Well, it was... The reason I did it was the story. I mean, I'm a writer. I was working for the newspaper. I was looking for stories, and horse racing is rich in stories. You can't not. I mean, I realized right away, my first year at the Baltimore Sun, they sent me the Kentucky Derby and asked me to pick the winner in the paper. I knew nothing, and I did pick the winner. And I think I picked it the next 25 years in the paper and got them all wrong. But I got the first one right. But anyway, I just love the whole thing. From a storytelling perspective, you got the richest of the rich. You got the underclass there that's working with the horses. You have the horses, the drama of it. The Triple Crown is really what I did a lot of. So we had the one here just year after year. Great stuff. And I loved it. And so, you know, then I wound up writing books about it just because the storytelling was so good. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time. No, not a rail bird at all, but I was mentored in it by, you mentioned the name, Dale Austin, the late Dale Austin, great turf rider at the Baltimore Sun. Always had
Jack Mann, all those guys were out there doing it at that time.
All of it.
You got here, right?
All of it. And they, you know, I'm sure they looked at me, listen, I know how that crowd works, and I was the young guy, and they're looking at like, who is, you know, he doesn't know anything. But anyway, they were nice enough to take me on and really taught me about it. And so I was able to write. I mean, the first book I ever wrote, I've written 11 books. The first one was a Kentucky Derby story, The Longest Shot, story of a 1992 winner, Lil E.T., who was an obscure winner, but I did the story for The Sun, and it was so amazing. The horse almost died as a yearling and then was flipped for $3,000, which is nothing. This is a Kentucky Derby winner. So I did the story for The Sun, and I said this, I was looking for a book to write, and I said, I think this fits the bill. So I took it on, and a few years later, had a book in my hand.
And the horse still hadn't talked, right?
The horse is dead. The horse doesn't talk. The horse doesn't talk. So, but it was a great story, and I sort of learned how to write a book on a horse racing book. So wound up doing a few more.
Well, you brought it up just visiting at the bar here, Casas, about them ripping down Pimlico and what is going to be done, and the banners. And you and I would both agree the banner's doing a great job with journalism. I mean,
definitely. Yeah. Sports side of it, really, really good. I'm a fan.
Well, the Tucker story, the Mattis story, you know, the bigger stories that have come out.
Yeah.
You know, asking questions of John Harbaugh, who's currying favor with President Trump.
Great columns. Kyle Goon has written some great columns. I mean, that's what I did in this town for 27 years, and I'm sitting here watching, and, you know, I know a good, the right column to write when I see it, and he's written a handful of them really good.
And well, this horse racing thing, let's talk about this, because you had some natural interest, and I haven't talked at all about the dismantling of Pimlico and what – the level of expectation should be. I mean, I sat here, did an hour on how baseball could get saved with these people and fans and money in this town and where it's going to come from to fill the stadium up. The horse racing thing is one of these things during your 40 years here and my 40 years in doing journalism here. We've watched this thing deteriorate pretty good. I mean, really.
It has. It has. I haven't done the Preakness in however many years, 10 or 12 years. And I'm just amazed. But I did 25 or 30 of them. And I cannot believe when I looked this year, for instance, at and I think the TV coverage, they were cutting out some pictures. The grand, I mean, it was pretty empty. I mean, not literally empty, but compared to what it used to be, it was. I don't know how you screw that up, because that was pretty incredible for a long time. 100-something thousand people there, huge crowds, just amazing what went on. It was nuts. It was completely nuts, which I liked. But it was so, yeah, and there's so much history. That's what I started doing. I wrote a book about Native Dancer, who's a very, very famous horse, didn't win the Triple Crown, but is buried out at Sagamore Farm. And that got me sort of down the history rail of it.
And we just lost Ron Turcotte this week.
Yeah, lost Ron Turcotte. But even with because in doing the Native Dancer book, I got to know Alfred Vanderbilt's son, Alfred the Third, I think he is, and so he was very helpful to me writing this book. I mean, his dad was long dead, but he's a little older than me, and we hit it off, and he's got his dad's, you go interview him at his house in Connecticut, and he's got an entire room full of horse racing trophies. It's just worth millions. It'll just floor you. So you start getting into the history of it, and Native Dancer, and of course, Kevin Plank has fixed up Sagamore Farm, which was a very historic place. So yeah, the history of it, and at Pimlico, there's just a lot. There's a lot of history. There's murals on the wall. There's trophies. There's all sorts of stuff. Very honestly, Nestor, that is a book idea that I had that I'm not going to act on. And that was the dismantling of Pimlico and the building of another one. It's pretty fascinating, because you can talk about exactly what you said. It's a once great American sport that's deteriorating. There's incredible history, very moving to a lot of people. However, nobody really cares anymore. And so, but anyway, do you preserve it? How much do you preserve? How do you preserve it? What happens going forward? There's just a million questions. An interesting narrative with the teardown of it. And who knows how it's going to end. I sure hope they build another one.
I think that's something for our society and sports, and you having spent your whole life documenting it, me having spent my whole life documenting Baltimore sports, is that you said there's a very moving story in the history of it. There's a very moving story in the history of the Orioles and Jim Palmer and Brooks Robinson and how that turns into Adam Jones, that turns into, you hope, Samuel Basayo here this week, right? Like, that is what makes this nonsense even special, other than gambling on it, right? Like, which is where baseball and football would like to take it. But, like, I collect the old belt buckles, the old football belt buckles from 1971, and seeing the old logos of the Chargers and the Baltimore Colts and the St. Louis Cardinals and the Oakland Raiders. And, like, the history and the pageantry is where the storytelling came from, to little John Eisenberg and little Nestor Aparicio to say, we're going to be storytellers in this space of nonsense, in reality, but trying to tell people why it's important, or why it's poignant, or why it's significant. And to your point, like, these stories were really, all of those old horse stories are just tearjerkers and people and animals and all that, but it feels like it's almost like the Harriet Tubman trail to Donald Trump. It's history that needs to be erased, or it just doesn't matter anymore. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think it's the storytellers that keep that story alive. And when Pimlico goes down and 10 years from now it is whatever it is, there's not going to be any more thoughts of what used to happen out there on the third Saturday in May. And I'm not even sure in the industry whether it's even possible, because they're not going to get the horses anymore unless they figure this out.
Yeah, I refuse to believe that there's just zero interest anymore, and I'll just keep telling it. I mean, what I'm doing right now, I'm not working on a book. I'm doing this bird tape still, on Substack, birdtapes.substack.com, and it's an Orioles history project. It is ongoing, I've got interviews lined up with players. I think there's 50 interviews now in the archive, and I'm now writing you know, fair amount of Orioles history, just because there is a market for it. I got a nice subscriber base, a lot of people.
It's like a book that doesn't end, like,
yeah,
to some degree,
just
right?
Just having fun with it.
Yeah.
People say, well, what are you doing? I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just, you know, I write. I like it. These stories are interesting. And so I find there is an appetite for it. I hear from a lot of people.
Well, with the Orioles specifically, because it is special, horse racing has deteriorated to the point where, like, we're wondering, right?
Horse racing, for sure.
And I'm seeing this with baseball, where I'm watching it deteriorate and saying, come on, Katie, come on, David, somebody come in here and make sure that it's not going down the same pathway, because it certainly feels that way to me when they're talking about work stoppage next year and just what they're going to do with their television and just all of that. But the bird tape thing that you're doing, that piece where it matters so much to people's lives that they want to hear it, and I think which is most important that you're the one doing this, especially you, even, you know, I love those Oriole teams and all of that. You covered them. You wrote the book almost 30 years ago now on all of it. The way that you come at it when you get Fred Lynn on the phone to know enough about it to get the best stories out of these people, that's part of this too, is that the storyteller needs to have a rich history in all of this so that the tapestry, the stories can be told the right way. So when you're doing this bird tapes thing, it's different than a 20-year-old kid doing it or even Cal Ripken's kid doing it. You're coming at it from a different perspective with these people. Who are the last five you've done? Who are the next five? Where's your lane here, because I know you're trying to get guys that are alive.
Well, definitely that. Well, one interesting thing I've done, but when I wrote my oral history of the Orioles, and it was 2001, so what are we, 24 years ago.
Okay.
So I did not interview the writers. You know, I was looking for story, the whole thing, and it's a 550-page book, storytelling, right? And I talked to players, I talked to broadcasters, I talked to scouts, managers, general managers, everybody. I didn't talk to the writers. And so because already, very honestly, I had enough material. I wasn't going to write a 1,000-page book. So this time around, you know, I said, I woke up one day, I said, I should talk to these guys. And I know them. They're like my friends or colleagues. And
They
will return my calls. It's easier to get them. But, you know, let me talk to them. So one thing I've done is started, I've now posted 4 interviews with former beat writers just about their days covering the Orioles. And they've all gone on to big things. Dan Shaughnessy, Tim Kirkchian, actually, I just put up today, Kenny Rosenthal and Fox, and Richard Justice, all great journalists and great reporters, and their Oriole memories are unbelievable. And so I'm really proud of those interviews. You know, Dan Shaughnessy told the story, and of course he's a very famous guy at the Boston Globe now. It's just pure gold. He it's a coming of age story. He came to Baltimore in the mid 70s, 1977, and as he said, I just got out of Holy Cross. The only thing I knew how to do was drink. He didn't even know how to open a checking account. And he had so many stories about it. It's such an unvarnished time in baseball. And it's the Orioles' glory days, but you cannot believe it. He had so many stories about Earl and Palmer and all these guys and moments where their hair's been let down. And he's just interacting with them on a personal basis as a young kid. And it's really a coming-of-age story. He told me a story that there was a year where, and he got along with Earl, that they were going to the winter meetings were in Hawaii. Okay, and so Dan is going to go. So Earl's going to go, and Earl's stepdaughter, okay, Earl's stepdaughter living with him out in Perry Hall is going to go too. But Earl's coming in late, all right? Earl's coming into the winter meetings late. So, and there was a flight. Major League Baseball was going to do a flight from JFK in New York out to Hawaii. Anybody from the East Coast could get up there and get on that flight. So Earl his stepdaughter on that flight, and Dan's on the flight. So they're at the bus station, the bus stop in Perry. Is it Perry Hall? You know, where you take the buses up to New York?
Go ahead.
And so Earl's like, they're going to spend one night in New York, Earl's stepdaughter and Shaughnessy. They're going to spend a night in New York before they get on this flight. So Earl's like peeling off 20s. They're getting ready to get on the bus to take him to New York. Earl's not getting on the bus, but he looks at Dan Shaughnessy and says, you're the same age as her. You take care of her in New York tonight. He's peeling off 20s, handing them to Dan. Take care of her tonight in New York, and we'll see you in Hawaii when that flight. And Dan said, could you imagine that happening today?
John Harbaugh saying, take care of my daughter. I'll meet you in Hawaii. Here's a $20 bill.
And so, I mean, what a story. So
well, I've had Shaughnessy on before too, and I think of that period of time in the Earl Weaver book and writers, Have you seen the picture of Weaver dousing Phil Jackman in the locker room?
No.
There is a picture, and this surfaced, and I saw it, and I sent it to Phil Jackman's daughter. I don't have the whole story, but apparently Phil Jackman lost some sort of bet or wrote something about...
Well, they used to bet on who was going to hit a home run.
And he's wearing a shirt that says lifeguard on it. And this is after the 1971 ALCS. It is a picture of Earl Weaver dousing Phil Jackman with beer in the locker room.
Yeah.
And Jackman's shirt says lifeguard on it. And I don't, there's no story to this, but this is a sports writer in a locker room in 1971.
Yeah. Well, that's
this sort of thing doesn't happen anymore, Eisenberg.
Oh, it doesn't happen at all. And actually, Tim Kirkchen, we spoke at length about it. And, you know, it's in the interview that just got posted today about how the access is so much less. There's so much less access. And how his era, and that's the 80s, say, from the 70s, the 80s, even into the 90s, great access around baseball. You could get into a clubhouse for three hours before a game. And so what comes out of that is great stories. Great stories, one after the other. No more. You know, with 45 minutes of access before a game, everything's behind a podium. It's certainly true in football as well. Almost everything's behind a podium now.
Did you get out at the right time?
Yes, I got out.
Did they throw me out at the right time?
Yeah. Oh, I definitely got out at the right time. I mean, just from a storytelling perspective, with everything at a podium now, I feel badly for... I mean, that's not to say that there aren't good people out there still doing good stuff, but the access has really changed, and the access is where the good stories come from, the great stuff comes from, and it's not there anymore, not even close. So
if you got a kicker who's a predator and you're trying to hide it, or you have untoward things going on, or you're just a paranoid organization to begin with, or you want to control the message. I mean, the thing I see in modern sports, and this is just in the last couple of years, is that they're just doing reality TV on the internet. That's all. They're just shooting videos of everything. And the Penn signing the contract, the behind the scenes, I'm promoting you, I'm cutting you, all of it's on video, all of it's made to look like a Hulk Hogan reality show where it might be Ozzy Osbourne, it might not, but it's all staged.
Yeah.
It feels like Owings Mills and the Oriole organization.
It's a backdrop.
It is a staging area for a reality show, like The Bachelor. Like they're shooting a television show in addition to the games being played.
Well, there's definitely, and nobody does it better. I mean, it's universal. It's not just here. Look at what's the biggest show on Netflix right now? The Jerry Jones documentary and the Cowboys. And that is the number one show. And so when I was just down there, my mother, still alive at age 98, I go down to see her, and I'm listening to the radio down there, and they are killing him. Killing Jerry Jones. And this is a well-done documentary. I haven't seen all of it. It's about Jerry Jones's history with the Cowboys. But there's, you know, he admits in the thing, basically all I want is attention. And he's really good at it. He may not be good at putting football teams, winning football teams on the field, but he's good at attention.
Jerry's a big deal.
He's a very big deal. And, I mean, now he's number one on Netflix, you know. He can't win a playoff game, but he's number one on Netflix. And does he really? That's all he wants?
He's
kind of fine with it.
Who thought he was just getting a television rating would be.
Right. Well,
and it did translate.
Yeah. I mean, listen.
He got votes.
You can make that leap very easily. But it is. It's very definitely a media world we live in. And so, you know, and that's fine. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and grumble and, you know, get off my lawn and things, you know, it was better in my day and all that. You know, this is the world we live in now. People consume it in great volumes and they like it and they're interested in it. It's very different, you know, and certainly the players control the message and the teams control the message. I mean, one thing with the Ravens, I mean, you know, half of them have their own YouTube channels and they're controlling the message and whatever. Go and do it. That's fine. I will stick to my lane, which is, you know, come in unbiased, see what I see, tell a story. It won't always be a good story. It's going to piss some people off. And so be it. You know, live with it.
How you won, if you won, why you won, why you lost, how it happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, I walked the halls. I've worked for the Ravens for 9 years. They brought me in and said, you do what you do. And I said, okay, let's see how this goes. And
here you are.
I lived to tell about it, and that's not without doing a lot of the knocking heads with, you know, some people who are on TV every Sunday. But, you know, it worked out okay. They were, definitely for public consumption. Really nice to work for, good people, And they dealt with me. They dealt with me. I think some of them couldn't figure out the whole time I was there why I was there. But
including the head coach.
Definitely not. But Dick Cass, the former president, he did. And so pretty much had my back.
Accountability is just something you either think you're subjected to it or you're not, right?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting thing to write in a column, you know, after a game that I think I'm going to have PTSD with these decisions to go for two to win a game in overtime. And, you know, you're standing behind the guy who made the decision who's not happy with what you wrote. And that was interesting, but I live to tell about it.
Well, John Eisenberg is here. He is living to tell about it. We're at Costas Inn. We're in Timonium at the beautiful OTB. We've talked some horse racing. Pressure Luck and Lucky Sevens Doublers. I'm also going to be at Coco's on Wednesday. We're going to get to Sláinte in September in time for the Oyster Tour. And we're doing tastiness as well. So a lot of food coming out this week. A lot of football coming out next week. Do you want to do baseball or football? Which one do you want to do? Let's do Orioles since you did Bird Tapes and where we are.
Okay.
Where are you in all of this Basayo and... I just had Howard Scherer for a while, my childhood friend. He's still got $1,000 on his Birdland account this year. It's use it or lose it, you know. So they've done all they've done with their Birdland things and their angering fans. This Basayo thing, I spent an hour this morning talking to Luke about it. And when it happened, I kind of shrugged and I'm like, well, this is the guy they could sign. This is a marriageable player. Poor Dominican young there, hasn't proven himself yet. If he comes up, it's 300 for a month. He might want more money. Not a Boris guy. Most of these guys, they can't sign this deal to, right?
The Boris thing is...
Fundamentally, Scott Boris, if I had him on the show right now, he literally would say, that's a shitty contract that young man signed, but he did what he had to do. You know,
yeah.
He wouldn't do that with me because he's probably worth $200 million in that period of time if he becomes what they think he is.
Yeah.
But they got over on him because he's a poor kid from the Dominican. They bought a year or two of his deal. But by the time he gets to that deal and he's gotten screwed out of the first $50 million, he would have wished he had me. That's how Boros would think about it, right? But this young man just had his life set up, right?
Yeah.
This is like saying the lottery's got a $750 million drawing right now, Powerball, right?
I mean,
this is like saying $75 million wouldn't be enough for me. Right?
It's
like,
all relative. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money that kid just signed for. And
for
whatever
him.
The market bears or whatever, don't even come at me with that. You know, it's just like, there's a lot of money he signed for. He's a 21-year-old kid. He barely made it to the major leagues. It's a pretty good deal. And so he could get hurt. He could tear up his Achilles tomorrow and never be the same. And fortunately, he's not a pitcher, right? I mean, they all get injured. But
if you're writing, is this a good signing or bad?
Absolutely. Good signing.
Okay.
Good signing. 100%. Good signing, especially you get a look at him. I mean, the kid's good. He's a good ball player, really good ball player.
We thought that about Rutschman 3 years ago, though, right?
Yep.
I thought that about Jonathan Scope. I was the guy that didn't think Chris Davis should get the money. I thought Jonathan, so I am the village idiot in all this.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of money to them.
It is a combination of factors. The signability thing, I think, is huge. The Boris thing really gets in the way. And so this is one they could sign. And he is 21 years old. I think it's smart. I think it's smart. And this is a looks like a really nice player, a nice piece for a long time. I don't think he's going to be hitting 210. And, he's a great athlete. He doesn't have to catch. He can play first base. He was a shortstop when they were scouting him. He's a great athlete. And big, strong kid, super strong. Go for it. Go for it. I mean, what are you waiting for? So tired of. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, when the Angelos regime said, well, we can't afford Manny Machado, I said, well, why don't you sell the team? I mean, you're in the business. You are in the business of baseball. And here you have done what you're supposed to do. You have found a kid. You've developed him. He's a star. If you can't afford him, we'll sell the team. I mean, what are you doing? This is the industry,
a problem, right? I mean,
yeah.
the work stoppage coming next year, where they are, as I pointed out in the last segment, they don't have any revenue certainty.
Well,
you know what I mean? Like, they don't know where their money's coming from. They really don't.
Well, they're trying to, get ahead. I mean, the drying up of the regional sports networks is an interesting thing, and they're just trying to figure out how that's all going to go. And, I mean, it is. I mean, I do think, baseball definitely has some things to consider and to work on. And I don't know how it's going to work. I do still think there's an awful lot of fans. It's not what it was, and they got things to work on. I think it. But I do think some things are eternal. I mean, look at what's going on in San Diego with the Padres. You put a winning team, some fun team. You know, market it the right way. You can draw. You can still draw. L.A. Dodgers. I mean,
the bananas draw, John. Right? I don't get it, but they do. You know,
yeah, well, just people want to have fun. They want to have some fun. And have it not just be dreadful and sort of like, you know, just like a funeral. They want to have
some
fun.
Are the Orioles fun when you go down there? Is it fun to you? I often say to my wife, that's the thing that's missing for me. And I'm different. I'm uninvited and, you know, whatever. But it's not fun for me. It's why I don't give them money. Even if I hated them and I was having a good time, you know what I mean? If I don't like the restaurant owner and the steak's good, I might still have a steak, right? But just in a general sense.
I'm the wrong guy to ask because I enjoy it. You know, I'm the one who watched all those years when they were terrible. I watched through the rebuild. I just like I just like baseball, and I do have fun win, lose, or draw. I think it's interesting. I'll watch when they're 10 games under 500 and they got people I've never heard of trying to close games. I mean, I will watch it. So I do find it fun. I find baseball. I mean, I came up here. From football country, Texas, and I found that I enjoyed writing baseball a lot more than football. And baseball, even though the Orioles were lousy when I got here, I enjoyed writing it. Again, the access. Let's go back to it. You know, it just spoke to my heart. I could go in there and spend hours, and I would write something and go in there the next day, and they would yell at me. But that was fine. Whatever. That's the way it should be. You know, they I like the baseball. So
all right,
I
so
do
30th anniversary of Cal. Coming up this week, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in addition to that little game in Buffalo on Sunday night. But
right.
You and I were both there for all of it. I mean, I was standing next to you most of those days. I mean, back in the 90s, from Camden Yards on.
Yeah.
We were colleagues, and then you were writing a column, and I'm doing radio every day in that period of time, 95, 96, 90. What 96 and 97 and 98 became for the franchise and the Ravens coming to town and all of that. It was sort of the last pure act of the Orioles, right? Like 30 years ago, it's sort of the last thing that really mattered.
Yeah.
Other than a Delmon Young double.
Right.
And maybe the Pope coming to the stadium or whatever, like Billy Joel and Elton John, maybe, or Paul McCartney. But like the Cal Ripken moment, still 30 years later, they haven't come close to having anything like that there, especially when they've gotten their ass kicked in all the playoff games. You know what I mean? Like the Royals thing didn't go well last couple of years. The times they've made the playoffs – it hasn't gone well. That period with Cal after the strike that led to 96, 97, big payroll, good teams, all
good.
Of that. That's all
the last
hurrah. That's it.
Well, I mean, there was some stuff in the Buck Showalter years, but certainly nothing that measured up to that. And yeah, the Cal stuff. It was, and listen, I wrote a whole book about it. A book about endurance in baseball because I found it to be a topic you could just, especially. 20 years hence, or now even more, 30 years hence, is it a good idea? Isn't it a good idea? Listen, you can talk to a lot of people in the game, get a lot of different answers.
Nobody's going to do it again, so that speaks to it not being either not a good idea or not doable. Not doable.
Yeah, I think Cal would be an interesting one to talk to about it in that regard. It's like, you know, in this day and age, they can sit you down and say, you want to play 162 games. Good for you. However, let me show you this spreadsheet. When you take a day off, you know, your average spikes 65 points. You're taking days off. Sorry, pal. And
load management.
Yeah, load management. So they can quantify anything. So it's just not valued anymore, the endurance. But you talk to guys, you know, Brady Anderson, talk to guys that, were teammates of his, and the value of having a guy in there and running the defense from the shortstop position, very underrated. You know, there's many ways to look at it. It's an interesting subject. And he did it. He did what he did. It was quite amazing. And, that's who he is.
We began this with the lore of horse racing and, like, the history and the pageantry. When you look up Orioles baseball, there's going to be Brooks and some championships. And then this Cal thing that sits as this bizarre outlier. It's a category that's not even really a category in baseball. It's not like 56 game hitting streak or how many rings you win like Michael Jordan. It's Cal created his own, it's its own industry, it's its own thing.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because there are two subsets of people's of responses. There's the people that say, yeah, we did that, we're proud of it, he's a local kid, it's incredible. And then there's the other ones that say, it had nothing to do with winning, who cares? You know, when who cares?
But the sentimentality of what it means for the city and the hardworking and the earnestness,
yeah,
and going to work every, you know, all of that, those are just great American ideals that
they are.
You know,
and
he
that,
had
that
at
wins.
The time. Well, the game was about to go into the steroid era, just come out of the strike. I mean, just saving baseball and all that 30 years ago, dude.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and the yeah, I mean, I when I did the book on it, I did interviewed all sorts of people, and including a lot of, you know, umpires who were on the field that night. Al Clark, you've probably had Al on, and he was like, you know, we didn't like, speaking the royal we with umpires, we didn't really like Cal. You know, his dad hated umpires, and he got it from his dad, and he was kind of arrogant, and he was always thought he was right. However, boy, did we respect him. And, you know, did we, you know, watching so many people take days off doing this, and I don't want to bat against Randy Johnson. I said, that guy showed up, you know, there's no doubt he deserves the acclaim he got.
So. I don't want to bat against Randy Johnson. He got me sideways with Rafael Palmeiro. He chased me with a bat one time because I went on the air, and everybody knew he didn't want to play against Randy Johnson. He didn't like that he was added on that.
Yeah.
John Eisenberg is here, the great man, author, writer. So what else is going on besides Bird Tape? So that's it? That's what you're doing?
That's all I'm doing right now.
Good.
And that's enough.
Enough.
That's
enough.
That's enough. I wrote 11 books. I'm not saying I'm done. And there may be something may grow out of that. It's possible that something will grow.
If I made you write a book today, what would you write it on?
If I wrote a book today,
give me $1 million right now. You're gonna write a book. What's your best book idea? What do you got?
My best book idea. I mean, I feel like writing. I've done a lot. All these deeply reported books. You know, I am wanting to write a memoir. Very honestly, it's a baseball themed and sort of. It's amazing how things thread through your life at different times. I mean, I wrote a lot of football history, and I thought, oh, I'm a football guy. But then you think more and more about it. It's like, I'm not so sure I am a football guy. I think I'm a baseball guy, and it goes back to my dad. There's a lot to unpack there. So I don't know. I don't know that it'll happen.
Stole the Washington Senators as a young man and also lived to tell he read Seasons in Hell, which is still my favorite all-time sports book. You know that, right?
Oh, well, Seasons in Hell about the 1973 Texas Rangers.
Mike Shropshire.
Yeah, who I knew well in Texas. I believe Mike's still alive.
I hope he is.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to have him on. Yeah. I've always loved that book.
Yeah, it's a
that
great book.
Book's great book, man.
Well, he's a really, really good writer, funny, and that is a different window. That's a different era of baseball. That was pretty nuts.
Not ball four, not, you know, not Harry, Ted, and whatever their names were, Alice and Bill, whatever their names were.
Yeah.
But, John, you know, the football thing is here now, and the Tucker thing and the journalism. I had Chris Corman on. You said hello to him. Where are you with the Ravens trajectory in all this? Because if you're the storyteller and the arc of the story, and I talk to Luke about this all the time. I remember being in a locker room back when I was a real media member, and Marlon Humphrey sat at his locker after that Chargers loss and said, we're chokers. That was 5-6 years ago now, right? Like, I'm interested in the beginning of the year and the Buffalo. First off, how hard the schedule is. Buffalo, Detroit, they're going to see Flacco in week two for what all that is. Then Kansas City. They're going to get their demons all out in the first month.
Yeah.
Right? They get the first. But I, to me, not just young players where Zay Flowers is coming on or whatever. I want to see Humphrey. I want to see Ronnie Stanley. I want to see Roquan Smith. I want to see Mark Andrews. I want to see Lamar. I want to see Derrick Henry. Where are their 30-somethings in all of this for tread in September? Where are they October 1st? Where's the injury report? Are they 3-1? Are they 1-3? Are they 2-2? Are they 4-0? This first month is way more compelling from a storytelling standpoint than almost anything I can think of, given the Tucker offseason, given Mike Green and their need for him to rush the quarterback, although, you know, apparently rush some girls back in college. But Lamar, his greatness, Derrick Henry, they got a wide receiver that's going to the Hall of Fame. They have a coach who thinks he's going to the Hall of Fame. They've really got a lot of pressure on them in a way that it's good pressure. You want to think you have to win. But, man, when you're Ronnie Stanley and you're Lamar and you're Marlon Humphrey, and you've been through this several times, and the only thing you can do to be successful is to win the last game of the year. Whew! I mean, it puts a lot of pressure on September when, out of the gate, they have it really tough. They have the toughest schedule in the league the first month.
Well, the one thing they can't do is go 0-4. Things do happen. I mean, weird things happen, and that's not impossible to go 0-4. Listen, don't get me wrong. The Ravens have a really good roster. This is one of the, on paper, one of the better Ravens teams I've seen. Really good. Lamar in his prime, starting right there. Just so good. He's going to win so many games, and they've surrounded him. Took a few years, but they've surrounded him with great talent. The defense should be better than a year ago. I do like Zach Orr. I think last year they really missed Mike McDonald. That goes back to the time when I was there. That guy, I think, is a star, and they really missed him. I mean, he could have been the next head coach here, I think. You know, Mike McDonald, that's the kind of guy. But, you know, they let him walk. They weren't ready to make that change. The owner wasn't. So now he's head coach in Seattle, a smart organization, by the way. They went and found a smart guy. You know, that was a transition of sorts last year. I think they'll be better this year. But that doesn't mean they're going to get off to a good start. I mean, they better watch it.
I don't know how they can get better. I mean, you know what I mean? Better is they freight train teams for years. They've had two or three seasons where they've just freight. That's my point. I mean, well, they can be 4-0. You don't win the Super Bowl October
1st. No, it means nothing.
Yeah,
right. I mean, 0-4 would mean something. 4-0 wouldn't mean a lot. That it would set up a really nice season for them, and they'll have a nice season. And I anticipate that they'll have, they could go 2-2, still have a nice season. I think they'll have challenges in the league. I think the Bengals, they were lucky to beat the Bengals twice last year. The Bengals are tough. They didn't have, they're weird, and they got problems, but they give the Ravens a hard time, and so do the Steelers. They're way better than the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Ravens, way better at this point. However,
I hope they can prove that between now and the first time they see the Steelers.
Don't get me wrong. They'll probably split with them. You know, they can't beat the Steelers. They just can't do it. The Steelers, you know, it's not, the Steelers are
well,
not.
Well, the front part of the season's loaded with the Kansas City Buffalo thing. The backside is loaded with Cincinnati and Pittsburgh. And that's what's got me a little concerned about all of this because, you know, they're 11-6 or whatever, and they got to go on the road and win three games
they
in January.
They can do it.
I don't like that. I don't like that pathway for them.
No.
I like bye week and home games for them, and that's good. That's a really high, high bar, right?
How many years,
30 years of doing this, they've only had 3 or 4 years where they've had anything that even felt like home games in January.
Yeah, but look at the years they won. Look at the first year, on the road. On the road for, let's see, the first year, that first round at home, and then two on the road, and then a Super Bowl, right?
What are you talking about? 0-1. I agree. This is a different team, though.
It can be done. It can be done. However, you know, I know what you're saying, and you talked originally about sort of the storytelling and what the arc of the story is. The problem is it's the same story. This has been going on for a while here, and the story hasn't really changed. It's like, well, they have to do this. This is what they have to. They have to win it all. I mean, they've done pretty much everything else. So, from a storytelling perspective, it's kind of like ho hum. It's the same thing. It was the same as last year, same as the year before, and you got the same coach, you got the same quarterback, got the same pretty much everything. So it's just, can they finally do it? That's the story.
They've been deft at handling all this with the veterans. I mean, I have tweets 3 years ago that said if they got Derrick Henry, they'd be unstoppable. I believe that. I mean,
I believe that was a really good sign.
If they got Derrick Henry, they could win the Super Bowl. So I'm not going to back down from that. But I do. I'm from Missouri at this point. I need to go see it.
Sure.
And more than that, their schedule in September really puts a lot of early pressure on them. And especially when you're not seeing players play in the preseason at all. Just seeing this thing gel on the road, under the bright lights, in a place where things have not gone well historically up there for them, in good weather, which we expect there'll be good weather on Sunday night, but it's as important a September as they've ever really had, just from a expectation level for where they are, where all the veteran, they have a veteran-laden team now. They really do.
They have young guys, too. They have a veteran. I mean, they've had hit on a few drafts, which is nice. They've done everything except win the game they need to win, you know, in January. So, I'm not going to say, you know, tune in January. They have to get there. I fully expect that they will not really have a problem doing it, regardless of what happens, unless they go 0-4 and the season goes completely off the rails. I think they'll be there in January. They're just too good. So, too many of these teams can't get out of their own way. There's really a lot of teams that
we'll see Cleveland week two.
Yeah, Cleveland with Joe. God love Joe.
How about Joe?
God love Joe.
Is there any better than Joe, really?
What a disaster. What a disaster! If you're a Cleveland Brown fan, I mean, I love Joe, and you know what? He's gonna throw a beautiful ball when he's 55 years old. You know, he brings some things to the table.
I think he's hanging on to one of his kids gets in the league so he can throw to him.
You know? I mean, I love him, but you know, the fact that that's their choice is just like, oh my God, what are you doing? That's how I look at it, of course, and that's after the worst. The Deshaun Watson thing, which really doomed them for years. So I don't know how they're going to extricate their way out of that one.
All the years I've been doing this, I've known you 40 years. I've been doing it 42 now. Joe Flacco is my favorite all-time person that I've met covering. And I've got some people. I mean, I love Barry Trotz. I love Gene. I mean, there's so many. Marvin Lewis. There's a lot of people I've met through this that I'm like, man, these are really amazing. Mike Bordick's a great guy. Just great people that I've met.
Plenty of them.
Brooks, I mean, just great people. Flacco, to me, is the purest. Delaware, first-round pick. Nobody thought he could do it.
Yeah.
Not a Hall of Famer, but a Hall of good enough when he needed to be.
Very authentic.
Just bunches of kids. He's written his post-Baltimore story. He's been gone a decade. He's written this story in a way where everybody in sports roots for Joe Flacco, right?
Absolutely. and what I remember about him, best of all, is week after week, and I was right in my wheelhouse all those years I was covering it, is that win, lose, or draw. Hey, you know, he is at that podium after the game. If he's never one time threw a teammate under a bus, never once, and never said what kind of stupid effing question is that, took on any question, answered it. He was an adult. He was an adult from the get-go as a kid. You know, he just had that poise and that humanity to just whatever happened.
Good parents.
I can just deal with this. You know, bring it, whatever you want. And I just so respected that because, you know, how many years have I done this and seen people that just don't handle it?
Well, the Mark Andrews thing in Buffalo, we talked about that briefly.
Yeah.
The team and Harbaugh and everybody running from the Justin Tucker thing, the Mike Elias firing his manager on a Saturday
and not talking
and hiding
until Tuesday.
Hiding in another city until Tuesday.
Right.
Not just from reporters, but you're doing this to your fans. You're saying to your fans, I don't owe you anything.
Right, right. Yeah.
The lack of accountability. So I had Flacco on. You'll appreciate this. I had him on in February, maybe it was early March, at the end of the season. And I, you know, he and I are pretty flippantly honest and candid when we get together. But we're on the Zoom, and I'm in the show doing it. And I said to him, so when you were a rookie, I went up to Pittsburgh, and you played in the championship game, and you threw an ill-advised pick across the middle to Polamalu. You didn't see him. He snuck in. He's in the Hall of Fame for a reason. And broke your heart, lost the game. 15 minutes later, season's over. You lost a chance to go to the Super Bowl. I'm standing in front of the podium. You came out. I probably asked the first question because I usually did. Why did you answer questions? Why did you come out? Why? And he said, well, to be honest, I didn't know I had any other choice.
Yeah, he's 22. He doesn't know how it works.
So I thought that was just Joe being Joe, as we would
say,
right?
Oh, I don't know.
I didn't have any choice.
Yeah.
But, you know, the more you – being with you specifically, and it would mean something with Luke or Jameson or Jeff Zrebeck, anybody who's actually been on the road, at home, in all of those little cramped Cleveland visiting room, Denver visiting
after
room.
After a loss.
After losses, after wins, after Jacoby Jones. We were there for all of it. I would say to you with Joe, when you ask him a question, you just didn't get what you get from Mark Andrews, whatever Chad told him to say or whatever Chad told him he should say. Joe would actually like explain it to you like he really wanted to answer it.
Yeah,
like it was a, like, oh, that you know, I can understand why you want the answer to that. Let me tell you about it. And that's how Marvin Lewis always treated me 30 years ago, and even Brian, which is sort of like, we sort of owe you an explanation because we're football people and you're not. You know, we're the teachers, you're the students, you know, you're the fans, we know why and how without throwing anybody under the bus. But I am the most appropriate person to answer that question because I'm the expert and you're the journalist asking me the question. Like, that seems to be the quid pro quo, the appropriate way it was handled, not you're just here to stir up stuff, right, after a game, right? Joe never took it that way, and I think that comes from a generation of even the headiest, Lou Piniellas, the fiery people.
Oh, they took those questions.
They knew you had to ask why you had a reliever in a game and why you didn't, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, I do believe Joe was a baseball player. I do believe that has something to do with it. I mean, the questions, you're not second guessing, but you have to ask, you know, why did you bring in so-and-so at that point if he gave it up? Why? I'm not saying stupid question. You know, I'm not saying I think you're wrong. I'm just saying why. Give me your explanation. It's going in the paper, right? I mean, it's going.
And I remember when Johnny Oates got that concept, it changed him a little bit for me.
It's changed them all. I mean, poor Phil Regan was here for a year. He couldn't take it. He couldn't take it. But most of the good managers understand that.
Buck
totally got it.
Buck.
Well, he'd been in the media by the time he got here, so he totally understood. Yeah, decisions that go wrong, people are going to ask you about them. It doesn't mean that, you know, they're second-guessing you. Maybe they are going to second-guess you, but you're going to have a chance to explain yourself here. And do it. Just do it. And
what were you thinking here? That's
yeah,
all.
What were you thinking? And, you know, it didn't get that a whole lot. Football, it's a lot harder after a game to get that.
I'll look at the tape.
You don't get it. So you just have to write what you write. And that's where I was.
Well, he's done better at it than anybody. John Eisenberg is here. He writes what he writes. And we're at Eric Costas. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. By the way, I'm doing my 27 favorite things to eat. Yeah, if you like to eat, I'm trying to mix things up. I mean, there's desserts in there. There's snowballs. There's cookies. There's cakes. There's pies. There's Crab Imperial and Oysters Rockefeller here at Costas, which you should definitely eat. The hashtag is tastiness. It's all brought to you by our friends at Curio Wellness, as well as GBMC, getting me healthier here into the fall season. And I hope our health makes it through this football grace period here, the early part of the season, through the Orioles off season. They're going to spend money, right? That's your
I think so.
Columnist John wants them to buy pitching, correct?
Definitely, or trade for it. Yeah, you know, whatever. Trade for it and sign it. Absolutely. I think if anything, this year has tested the patience of the fans as well. It should. This year's a screw up, big time screw up, and really, I think knowing fans saw it. You know, when the decision to bring in the people that they did, Morton and Sagano, and you know they turned out okay, but it wasn't an ace, it wasn't the big bucks.
You weren't going to win a championship.
You're just not going to do it. So, and you've got these young players. They didn't suddenly turn bad. I mean, you know, Gunnar Henderson just an outstanding player, and they've just got a whole. These new ones look good, and they got a lot of talent. They can't waste it. And
you
so,
worried about Rutschman?
Yeah, I am worried about Rutschman a little bit. I mean, Rutschman may end up. I mean, Matt Wieters was a 240-something career hitter, and part of the reason. And you know, Palmer. I do love Palmer on the Masson broadcast. And he was doing a game with the Seattle. They were playing the Mariners. And Cal Raleigh, right, 38 home runs at the All-Star break or something, or 40. I don't have the numbers in front of me, like five or seven since then. And you know what Palmer's response was? He's a catcher. He's tired. And it's just like, oh, yeah, you know, catching, it's hard to be the best offensive player on your team.
I go to yoga 3 days a week, and I was a catcher as a kid. And just getting – just doing this for like 30 seconds with my hips changes your countenance about all this. That would you prefer to do that every night or prefer to play first base or DH, right?
So it could come to that. I think Adley, I mean, I wouldn't mind. I would like to see him throw out a few more runners. That almost bothers me more than the hit a little. His defense, I mean, he's a very good defensive catcher. Calls a good game. There's going to be a learning curve here with Basayo on that.
Very I saw that under, with Dean Kramer the other night.
Very much so. I mean, the reason they didn't want to bring him up.
Everybody's because
of that. He caught 35 games at AAA.
This is why he wouldn't be up here if they were in the pennant race because they wouldn't want him catching Dean Kramer in a pivotal AL East game.
He caught 35 games at AAA, something like that. That is not enough. Okay, I'm just going to say that he's here now. He's going to hit. They've given him $67 million. That is not enough to really be. Are you going to go into Yankee Stadium and try to win games, or wherever it may be? It's not enough. So there's going to be a learning curve. We're all going to see it, and that's fine. I mean, development. We're not supposed to be dealing with it here, but with a player like that, you know, go ahead. Throw him out there.
In a last-place season, why not?
Why now? Yes, in August of this season, absolutely.
Beavers, too.
Beavers, Mayo, leave them all. Yeah. It'll pay. That's what you should be doing, and I believe it'll pay off. Beavers looks like a keeper. And I do believe Mayo is probably a keeper in the long run. I wish Kowser was hitting more than 210. Anyway, it's interesting to watch. There is a lot of talent, and they need to focus way more on, I mean, this is obvious, but the starting pitching. Because here, I mean, actually, we've had a pretty good record since before Memorial Day, a winning record. And that's when the pitching stabilized.
Well, Manzolino's going to bring it up when he wants to keep the job, too.
Well, he's definitely going to. And I was initially, I wasn't sure about him at all.
Boy, over his head so much.
I mean, and then there was the night he said, well, we didn't score enough points. And I almost, literally almost choked. I said, what did the manager of the Baltimore Orioles just say?
Earl Weaver's just yeah. rolling over wherever
didn't
he
have
is,
enough
right?
points. I was like, oh, boy. You know, I mean,
if my wife said that, I'd be worried about her.
So, but anyway, he's overcome that, which was real.
I don't know. I thought the whole thing feels really Little League. Feels
Just
the press conferences are not world class, for sure.
Well, they've gotten better.
Well, he's winning. They're winning, right? Well,
what I would like to see, I think an opportunity is here. Look what the Reds have done this year. You know, with bringing in Francona. Who had a health scare, but knows how to manage a 162-game season, knows how to manage a pitching staff. The
Bring
team's
back
not,
Buck. Bring back Buck.
I don't think he's the right. I love Buck. I mean, it would be great. I don't know if he's the right guy for young
players.
You were
there when they brought Earl back in 86.
Yeah. Well, one thing to know, let me tell you something about how. Still
writing a book about that.
One thing I do know from having done a lot of this Orioles history, Earl and that generation, even going forward, okay, Bruce Bochy today, all right, you go to a lot of these managers, they're good managers, they were not great players, okay, they were okay players, they didn't make big money, okay, and all of them, you go back to Earl and Billy Martin and all those guys, La Russa, do you know what speaks to them? Money, okay, because they didn't make it. So, you know, you can pay up and get yourself a good manager in the Rangers. Look, the Rangers went out and paid for Bruce Bochy. He was retired, I believe, and
won a
World Series out of it. I think people would make that trade here. That's something to go find yourself somebody.
John McNamara. I'm just
yeah. There's somebody out
Ralph
there.
Ralph Houksel out there.
Yeah, there's somebody.
Bob Lemon. He is John Eisenberg. He gets all of my funny little jokes that I make about baseball because he is a baseball historian as well as a football historian. Go read his books. Follow him. Get his bird tapes. I did have Fred Lynn on the show after you had him on your bird tapes because he's just like...
He's great.
And if I can get Kiko Garcia and one-up you, I will, damn you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Kiko would be good. Floyd Rayford?
I love the Honey Bear. You can have it. But Renicky was my favorite Oriole at that time. You know what? I should be in a mad race. This would be a huge get for either one of us.
John Lowenstein.
Brother Low.
Absolutely.
Brother Low, who loves me, probably loves you too.
Yeah.
Brother Low wishes me happy birthday every year on my birthday on Facebook. He will not respond to coming on the show.
He will not muckrake.
We'll never know, will we, with him? Will we?
No, we won't.
He really left in a cloud of dust like Hunter S. Thompson. He left like Amelia Earhart on a plane. He just went away, didn't he? Literally.
Not a month goes by where I got a lot of subscribers on this bird tapes thing. I hear from a lot of people, and they say, here's who I want.
It's him.
Yeah.
That's who I want.
Yeah. And
John, if you do him instead of me, I'm going to be good. I'll listen to it. I'll pay for it. I want to know that you're okay. I want to know.
I need
a sign. Knock three times. Do something, you know?
Absolutely.
Does he know how beloved he is here and in the aftermath of the Angelos thing?
Last time I talked to him, he was literally...
In Vegas, maybe?
On a golf course. He was literally, like, hitting a shot. And he put his phone down. And I said, what are we doing?
Him.
What are we doing here? I can't remember why I called him. It's been a long time.
I would see him randomly at Nichi Baikai. You remember Nichi Baikai's sushi joint on York Road? I would go in there for lunch. This is 30 years ago, beginning of my radio career. This is when he's on television every night. 93, 94, 95. I come in, and Brother Lowe would have sushi up at the bar in the afternoon. He'd say hello to me and whatever because he knew me through the media a little bit. But I didn't know him well. But he... really liked my show and the way that Mike Flanagan, the guys that were irreverent, he was an irreverent man.
Definitely.
He liked that I was irreverent. So, and when he got thrown out with the whole John Miller thing, I went back and I read those quotes when I wrote the Peter Principles, just about what he said upon departing. Dude, 30 years, man. Nobody has ever dropped the mic the way John Lowenstein just walked away and never came back. Literally never came back.
I should probably really do a written piece just on that.
Even Burt Jones is coming back in a couple weeks. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I heard about that. So,
well, that's after my heart. You know, 75 Colts were my thing. You know.
Yeah. But no.
Zach
no.
Back? Come on now.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I probably should just his departure really was something. So
I'm glad we talked about Brother Lowe.
Yeah.
I hope we out him. I hope we come on, Lowe.
Yeah.
Talk to go on Eisenberg's podcast. That's
right.
I'm not even lobbying for me. I'm lobbying for you.
Thank you.
Well, you'll have better questions. I'll just goof around.
I don't know
with
about
you.
That. I don't know.
I'll bust his chops. That's all I'll do. I miss him on the broadcast. John Eisenberg, if you miss him, since you're not following him out on social media, you can. Bird Tapes, Oriole historian, but also pretty good on the ponies, pretty good on the Iron Man thing, pretty good on the black quarterback thing. Speaking of black quarterbacks, I thought when your book came out, well, that's the end of racism in America. No, no, just no.
No, far, no, no, no. And it's really why I wrote the book. The book's Rocket Men came out 2 years ago. Just it's
Lamar didn't win the MVP last year.
yeah. I don't think. I
I don't know at this point.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I do know.
Yeah, no. I mean, he could have easily. He could have easily won the award.
I thought once Obama won twice, I thought, we're in good shape here. Nah,
yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah, no. The reason I wrote it, that's why I wrote it. I wrote the book. I knew it was not going to be a huge seller. I knew it was going to make people angry in the NFL, and all of that happened. But it happened. This is something that happened, all right? There was huge racism in the NFL.
Is.
And it happened right in front of my eyes, and I needed to get it down. I needed to get it down on paper.
Well, and I wore my Warren Moon jersey to make sure it was legit. Yeah. John Eisenberg here, author, friend. We're Costas and Timonium. You were the first one to write me. You're like, Timonium, right? Not Dundalk, right? Because when I used to say Costas, they knew what I meant in Dundalk. Now there's two. Get on out here for the State Fair.
Yeah.
It was mobbed in here all weekend. It'll be mobbed again. They're running the ponies out here at the OTB. All of it brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. I will have scratch-offs from the Ravens beginning next week. We're going to be at Coco's on Wednesday, and then we're coming back into football season. Luke and I got Buffalo ready to go. There's no playoff baseball to speak of, but there will be an active offseason. Plenty of things happening around here. I am Nestor. We are WNST. AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. I need some Crab Imperial. Back for more from Costas right after this.